Commerce Committee and Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, March 15th, 2007. We have an ambitious agenda. The chair will be leaving here in an hour and like 3 minutes. Senator Sparks will take over the chair. I would like us to get through the first three bills here in the next hour. Is Senator Torres Ray in the room? Is she nearby? She may have a bill in another committee, in which case I
should take her bill.
She just raced out. I think I will do my bill. Sparks.
No, this guy is, I think.
That's okay, because we'll start with mine and then.
Senator Schein.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if there's an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, there is the A1 amendment, I believe.
And is that the one? Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that. I don't have a copy of it. I'm sorry.
We'll get you one.
But I'd like to move that as an author's amendment, please.
It's the A1 amendment, author's amendment. It's in members' packets. On Senator Scheid's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Scheid.
Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Johnson's going to help me with this. This is pretty technical language. It's technical issues. And I don't think there's controversy in what we're doing. This is a continuation of modernization efforts that we began a couple years ago. We had what I would call much more major issues before us then. We made some decisions encouraging, setting up a regulatory scheme that encourages participation in our market by new companies and encourages people to stay here to provide good jobs here. Insurance company jobs are good jobs, and we want to encourage that industry to thrive and do well in our state. These are, as I said, pretty minor technical. I don't want to say minor. They're important, but very technical. And you have a bill summary, I believe. Section 1, I know what it does. I think maybe I'll just highlight for you. The section 1 is a conformity provision, and concerning commercial liability, it has to do with notice of changing coverage or reducing coverage, less favorable coverage or terms. They have to give 30 days notice from the prior to the expiration date instead of the current 60. Section 2 has to do with portability of life insurance product, clarifies the current law that says a former employee could continue their group life coverage staying on that employer's policy rather than purchasing an 18-month policy, an individual policy after the 18-month COBRA continuation period expires. So that would be less expensive to stay the group than to have to go out and purchase their own after the 18 months. So I think that's a good thing. Section 3 and 4 are very technical. Let's see here. They make changes that are part of a national effort by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners modernizing the way life insurers calculate their reserves. And this is really technical stuff, but these changes, the experts know, will result in being able to have more accuracy in determining the pricing on life insurance products. So that should benefit consumers if they are able to do that. And also enhances regulatory oversight as well, apparently, in that provision. So let's see. I believe the Department of Commerce has, yes, they've been involved in doing this, and actually we're taking a little more conservative approach than most states and by doing this through statute. So there is, I don't know, is the language on principles-based framework in there? I'm not going to go into that unless we, is that actually language in the bill? Okay.
Yeah.
If you have questions here in the bill, this has to do with Section 3 and 4 on principles-based framework. I would let Mr. Johnson explain that here as we get going after I go over just kind of the highlights. Sections 5 through 14 and then also Section 19 have to do with the NAIC life illustration model. So this section, I guess it must changes Section 45.025, saying that because that was done during the 80s, when interest rates were high, to ensure that actual or guaranteed interest rates, to the extent that they differed from advertised rates, were disclosed to consumers purchasing insurance and other financial services products. Well, that obviously was extremely important at the time. Unfortunately, that law, and it's an important feature, but it really wasn't tailored to insurance products. And so the Department of Commerce needed to adopt rules to make that work for insurers. Well, now they've developed a model that addresses the same disclosure issues, but it's designed to work for insurance products. So the disclosures will remain. That's important. But it's now tailored to insurance products. And actually, there's going to be much more comprehensive disclosure for consumers by requiring that all of the non-guaranteed elements of a policy are disclosed at the point of sale. So it's not just the interest rates, but all of the elements. So the other entities that are covered by 45.025, such as the banks, they all still have those obligations to disclose interest rates. This applies only to insurance. It applies only to insurance products. Section 16 is the right to cancel free look period notice. Current law allows consumers 10 days after they purchase to review and cancel a life or annuity policy with no penalty. This change retains that right, but it does create some uniformity by deleting requirements that are Minnesota-specific and obsolete, such as requiring that consumers have the option to cancel via telegram. So the new language is based on interstate compact standards and I think is not controversial, provides additional consumer protections, always a good thing. And then I'm going to ask Mr. Johnson to discuss this and also and the amendment that we adopted, if you would.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Senator Scheid had indicated this is the third year now that the bill has been brought to the legislature as a result of a collaborative effort between the insurance industry and meetings with the Commissioner of Commerce to update, modernize important areas of insurance law. And as Senator Scheid said, I think this year's bill is significantly more technical, and most of the language that you have in front of you, committee members, represents the actual draft language of model acts or regulations developed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So the 50 state commissioners work in numerous of these areas. The mortality tables, this is written by actuaries for actuaries, but it was written by the regulators to keep our laws and how insurers are regulated here modern and current. The mortality table updates are important because it permits, more favorable treatment for non-smokers. In other words, as the mortality tables have evolved, the data supports building into the pricing that kind of differentiation. Sections 5 to 14 and Section 19 represent, again, as Senator Scheid had indicated, model language that the companies, the agents throughout Minnesota, the regulators, it's actual life insurance illustration model act. This model act is way more comprehensive and detailed for what consumers get at the point of sale. It's been adopted, I believe it's in 38 or 40 states, so it's virtually uniform around the country. And it is a better disclosure about the contracts, its terms at the point of sale for consumers when they're buying. So, it's a model act. that is tailored for the insurance transaction, and the regulators and the agents and the companies nationwide are all seeking to pass this in their respective states. Those two represent 95% of the text and the language in the bill. The amendment, similarly, Mr. John Gross at the Commerce Department the other day asked if we could put on this bill the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act dealing with accelerated benefits under life insurance contracts. And here is another area where this is a plus from consumers, seniors in particular, and letting them access, if they want to, their benefits under their life insurance contract for use with long-term care expenses. So it adds a consumer option under state law that, as we continue to look for ways to help individuals deal with long-term care expenses, this is a good plus. They don't have to. It's an option if they want to utilize that. So that was the amendment that was put on the bill. And truly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think the other, there's a couple of sections I can describe them, but they truly are technical changes in terms of current insurance laws. If anyone here would like, I'd be happy to just point it out. There's some minor paragraph changes, but they're not substantive law changes. They're either codifying a current practice in terms of how the department operates on a particular issue area, or clarifying a current practice. But I and see if anybody wants to look at those, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Scheiden, Mr. Johnson, I'm always looking through these things when they're presented from the insurance industry specifically to see how they're going to affect consumers. And beginning with Section 1, it looks that provision would seem to me to be an anti-consumer provision in the sense that you are cutting in half the amount of time notice that you have to give an insured person that you're planning to change their rates to a more unfavorable or the policy in an unfavorable way and giving them a much shorter time to try to find an alternative, maybe get quotes from other companies and do comparisons. And having been through this process myself, and especially now being down here at the legislature and only getting home occasionally, when someone's on vacation, when someone's maybe away for a while, away for business, seems to me that 30 days is a very short window of time to allow the opportunity to try to replace the insurance, and that you're really squeezing consumers by with this provision. So I would definitely not be in favor of this bill with that provision in it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Shai.
Mr. Chairman, and perhaps Senator Olson does know this, but this is about commercial policies.
Well,
Senator Olson.
And I understand that you have individuals with small businesses and whatnot, but that is for commercial policies. It's not for individual private
Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
I understand that, Senator Scheiden, but actually, you know, like I'm a one-person law practice, and I'm sure there are lots of small business owners in my situation, and I just wonder what the problem is with giving 60 days worth of notice. The other thing, and also because it takes a while to get quotes back from other companies and to really follow up on this, it isn't the kind of thing a person can just do overnight. And then I have a question with one other provision, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Senator Olson, that's fine.
Section 16, the one that you said was just a technical change, and maybe I just don't understand this one quite, so I have a question there. It looked as though I can understand not worrying about telegrams anymore, but it says it did say you may cancel this policy by delivering or mailing a written notice, so that or sending a telegram, but there was a provision to allow a right to cancel by mailing a written notice. And now it looks, I'm just wondering, what does the consumer have to do now in order to cancel under the new language? It looked like they might actually have to, for the return of the policy to the company or an agent of the company. And if it doesn't say how they're going to, what they have to do to accomplish that return, I know that a lot of times I've run into many situations where there's an argument with the insurance company over whether something was, or not just insurance companies, but businesses in general, over whether something was received, you know, what happened to it. It's easy to say it wasn't done within 10 days. So So I'd like to see something more definite there that gives the consumer an avenue to be able to show that they met that without just leaving it to the discretion of the insurance company.
Mr. Johnson, would you like to address Senator Olson's question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, on the first one, on the commercial, the dilemma is actually the other side of what you just said. The problem is that with too long a notice period of these change of altered terms, in many cases the business doesn't know what the terms, the coverage, what they want to renew under, and by putting it too far a date out, then the insurer and the business are not able. In other words, they can't give them the rates and the changes if the business hasn't made decisions about what they want for coverage. The 30 days is actually longer than what most states do. This committee passed last week a bill that the builders had dealing with their CGL policies that called for a 15 days notice in terms of cancellation. Most states don't put a long time frame in there because it's actually counterproductive to the exchange between the business and the insurer. Tell the committee that in meeting with the department, which we've gone through the bill and flagged these issues and had the discussion, and that the Commerce Department has agreed with us that these are reasonable changes to the laws, that it works better for the business to not put too long a time frame out, because frankly then they won't be able to give them the way the negotiation process goes. If the markets are healthy, competitive, and working, which we have, that too far a notice out, you can't give the terms, the final terms, and it's actually it's counterproductive for the business. So in my opinion, the business isn't losing under this. This is actually enhancing how the business and the insurer interact in the renewal process, and that's just our experience. This law has been around in that time frame. It is not in sync with what we find around the country. And actually, as I indicated, the bill last week, the builders themselves, which they drafted, had the 15-day notice of cancellation provision. So we've just flat found it's not an issue. You don't need to have it out past that 30-day notice time period to give the business more than enough negotiation process.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. I just am going to have to respectfully disagree with you based on my own personal experience. I just had to renew insurance for my business, and I received the notice almost 4 months in advance, and they wanted an answer back from me with complete forms filled out 60 days before the policy would have expired. And so my experience has been that allowing the opportunity to do cost comparisons and some time to deal with this would be a much more consumer-friendly way to go. So that's just been my experience.
Then, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Johnson.
The last provision, actually, we need to update this language. This is language taken out of the Model Interstate Compact, which we adopted a year ago. So we're standardizing the right of cancellation. There is no diminishing under this language of the consumer's ability and the rights they have to exercise under the free look language and the ability to cancel. So all I can tell you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, is that this does not diminish in any way, shape, or form the consumer's rights that they currently have.
In terms of, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the right to cancel, that was the second half of Senator Olson's
Section question. 16, I understand.
Pages 19 and 20.
Mr.
Senator
Chair?
Olson?
Mr. Johnson, how before it looked as though there was something in place that would give the person who wants to cancel a specific way of proving notice of mailing. I mean, that really isn't addressed in this. It says return of the policy, and return leaves a lot of room for problems in terms of proof as to when the insurer receives the policy. Why can't there be language in there that would be similar that just says that they have to mail it within 10 days and that if they have proof of mailing, it meets the standard?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't think we have a disagreement here on. We're not substantively, in other words, the current rights that consumers have should be maintained. This was written also pre the era of electronic commerce. We've adopted in Minnesota the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act that didn't exist when this law was passed. everything is obviously what we're referencing of telegraphs was done in a format, much of which doesn't happen today. Senator Olson and I, whether here or as we go along, we are not diminishing, committed to that, diminishing consumer rights here. We need to update this law to recognize electronic commerce, and we think the Interstate Compact actually is the base that we've committed to as a state as of last year, and it's a good base to commit to because there is a uniformity in how these aspects of state regulation are going to be handled on a going-forward basis. But we're not in disagreement, I don't believe, on what you're commenting. I don't have words here today. If there's some that help you comfort-wise, we're willing to work with you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheiden and Mr. Johnson, then I would offer as an oral amendment, I think the language that was previously in the bill is fine. Beginning on line 19.29, if we inserted that language at the end of line 20.4 to say, notice given by mail and return of the policy or contract by mail are effective on being postmarked, properly addressed, and postage prepaid. To allow the opportunity to put this in the mail within the 10 days and not leave it with some avenue for proof rather than just leaving it to the insurance industry's discretion.
Senator Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's necessary, but it's fine. I think that the direction is very clear here to the insurance company what they have to do, and they would be in violation of state law if they didn't tell the consumer that. But if you want to, you know, prescribe the precise language, that's fine. That's fine. And I think she did. I'd like Mr. Stang to comment. I think that sounds like it works there.
Mr. Chairman, I think that works. Just moving that sentence that Senator Olson has described to the end of clause 3, I think would be an appropriate amendment.
Senator Scheid?
You're going to put that language on after the language on 20.4, line 20.4, right?
Okay.
That's fine.
On Senator Olson's oral amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. Senator Scheid, anyone else would like to speak on your bill?
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 1581 is amended, be recommended to pass.
And sent to the floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Scheid. Senator Torres-Ray, I think we're ready for you next.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I am back, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to have a conversation about this bill and what we needed to do to put the language in the shape that the committee wanted, but more than anything else, to really figure out how we can work together to provide, to encourage the health plans to provide coverage for the children that were here last week, and I have one today, and of course they are here to support your effort and to answer any questions that you may have. But as you may recall, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 504 requested your support to provide coverage for amino acid formula. And what we did was that we were able to have a conversation between the representatives of the health plans and the parents, and we came up with an agreement. We would like to present that to you today, and basically what we're trying to, what I'm trying to ask for today is for support of the original language that we have in place that I presented last week. And I have now with me Catherine, who is going to talk about the conversations that have taken place with the health plans who have agreed to do this. There is a technical issue that we need some time to address. You know, the health plans cannot collectively send a letter to the committee letting you know that they have agreed to do this. They have to do this individually, and this takes some time. So what we're proposing to do is that we would like to move this legislation to give them some time to come up with those letters and that agreement. And then if they don't move with this agreement, if we don't receive that letter, then we're going to proceed with the legislation. And if you have any questions for us, for the parents, it seems like everybody who's been pursuing this effort is very pleased with the results of these conversations. And so we're here to respond to any questions you may have.
Senator Torres-Ray, and thank you for continuing to, you know, have the conversation. Do members understand that it would be Senator Torres-Ray's intention to ask us to move her bill, and which I, you know, personally support doing, and that we know that would mean it would go as a mandate. It would, however, if the health plans are able to send letters saying that it's going to become, this coverage will be part of their standard medical policy, then Senator Torres-Ray is saying she will not pursue the bill, because clearly, as we learned last week, more people will have coverage if it's part of the medical policy. And I think this is not always or even often possible on these mandate issues. So, Senator Torres-Ray, I think I really am pleased that you're willing to have this conversation, because if we can make it work this way, it's really a better way for it to go. But I understand it's not, we can't say this, you know, for all the mandates that come forward, but this is a very specialized one, and an extreme hardship on a few number of people. And so I think there was some concern, and perhaps I'll ask Ms. Kmit, unless Senator Torres-Ray, have you had an opportunity to talk to Senator Marty? He's not here today.
I'm sorry. Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did talk to him last night, and he doesn't have to hear this bill. It's okay if we could proceed and just send it to the floor.
So that's good to know. And Ms. Kmit, did you wish to say something?
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I just want to say thank you very much to you and to Senator Torres-Ray and to the advocates who have spent so much time with us to help us understand and learn more about these types of conditions that require this type of supplemental formula. It's been a very good experience for us to go through, and I'm really pleased that we are able to come together and find a resolution to this issue. There's just one thing. I think you should have copies of a letter that I provided to Senator Torres-Ray. It should be in your packet.
It is.
There's one change, however, that I just want to call out. On the last paragraph of the letter, we had talked about I will be working with each plan, and I represent 8 health plans, each plan individually to get a letter from them stating that they are, in effect, planning to modify their medical policy procedures consistent with the legislation in Senate File 504 as amended. But I understand that we have some different timelines this year in the Senate, and so what we initially thought was instead of, we're going to move the date up to get the letters to you is essentially what I'm saying. So I'm hoping that, I think by the end of March we should be able to have those letters to you, and that would be March 31st, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yeah, I think we will have met the deadline in any case here for the bill. The bill doesn't have to be heard on the floor before May 21st, but...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that's the intent. We just want to make sure that we have the dates. We're keeping track of the dates, and hopefully, you know, we will be able to do all of this in a timely manner.
Okay.
And also, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to make sure that... I'm pretty sure that you have the current language. The language was distributed. There is an amendment that I neglected to mention during my presentation. And the A1 amendment basically introduces the new language into the bill that addresses this portion, this conversation that we're having. So it basically says that we will work collaboratively to come to an agreement.
Okay, and Senator Torres, sorry, we did adopt this amendment.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It just happened too fast, and I was confused about whether or not we adopted the amendment or not. But if we did,
we did do that.
So the current language already includes that.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And in that case, then Senator Olson would like to renew her motion from last week that Senate File 504, as amended, be recommended to pass. Are there any questions or any conversation or discussion members would like to have? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak on this? Did you want to say something? Or please just identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nona Narvaez, and this is my son, Robbie. And I am the founder and director of the Anaphylaxis and Food Allergy Association of Minnesota. You might have heard of us before with epinephrine legislation in the past. We are the organization that first approached legislators over a year ago because some of our members were affected by this issue. And we've created a coalition with the Organic Acidemia Association and the American Partnership of Eosinophilic Disorders and other organizations to try to change these policies. And we have had a wonderful response from the Council of Minnesota Health Plans and from the various insurance companies that are willing to work with us. And we feel very comfortable. We think this is a tremendous plan. And so we support what the council is proposing right now, what the insurance companies are willing to do.
Ms. Narvaez, thank you very much. And Robbie, thank you. Did you want to say hi to everybody here? You can do that. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi. I like you. You can go
ahead. So, Ms. Gmidt, I want to thank you very much for your leadership, for the council's leadership on this, and bringing everybody together to, you know, all the parties, the parents, the children, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So thank you,
members
very
of the
much.
Committee, too,
thank you.
For giving us the time to do that.
On Senator Olson's motion, then. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There we go. Okay. Then. Senator Latz, I saw him. Oh, right up here. Senator Latz, Senate File 1333.
Okay, here we go.
Senator Latz, I think that this, I'd like you to have just about 45 minutes, I think, if you, for the, you know, I really think that that should probably be able to deal with the bill in roughly that time. We do have three bills afterward that are not, I think, nearly as complicated or complex as yours, but we'll start going and see if we can do that.
I think we can do
Welcome
that.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Subject, of course, to discussion among the committee members. I've always been reluctant when judges ask how long will your case take, counsel. I never give them a number.
I'm not surprised, Mr. Lance. I think that's good policy.
Madam Chair, this is a bill that is kind of known by its shorthand, the Car Buyer's Bill of Rights. There is an author's amendment that I would request. I don't know if you want to handle that right now before I begin, or if you'd like to wait until after.
Well, Senator Latz, I think that it would put the bill the way you'd rather discuss it, right?
Yes, please.
Be
that would be
accurate.
The A5 amendment.
Okay, the A5 will be handed out here.
It's a card if you want to give it to your aide.
I know you've been working with interested parties, so is some of this amendment is a result of some of that? Am I?
Some of it is.
Yeah.
Some of it is not quite completely agreed to yet, and that'll be subject to some discussion, I'm sure.
Senator Scogin, would you move the A5 amendment to put the bill on the order?
Certainly will. Madam Chair, I move the A5 amendment for Senate File 1333.
On Senator Scogin's motion. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. Now you have the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The maybe what I'll do is just kind of walk through the bill to give you a summary of what the proposal does, and then I'll give you a little more detail on each of the proposals. The bill, Madam Chair, does a couple of main things. One provision is that it provides for a two-day return policy for used car purchases from dealers. Right now, if one were to purchase an automobile from a dealer, a used car, once you sign on the contract's bottom line, the vehicle is yours. And if you change your mind an hour later or a day later, you don't have a right to return the vehicle. It's up to the dealer's good graces to agree to take the vehicle back and unwind the transaction. This bill would provide for a two-day cooling-off period or a return period, and there are some conditions that would be attached to that, which I'll describe in a little more detail.
Senator Latsis, that starts on page 6. Am I correct? Section 11?
That's what's called the contract cancellation.
Bottom of page 6, members. So this is...
Would you prefer that I go through this in the order that's in the bill in front of you?
I do.
I think it would be easier.
Okay.
You know, and Senator Latsis, I understand why you're doing that, because that was kind of the cornerstone of this legislation, I think.
That's
that
correct.
Understood. Yeah. And so that's...
So it's easier for the committee to follow. I will go with the bill that you have in front of you. There are some definitions up front, which counsel can probably explain a little more clearly than I, but it fits some of the terms that are necessary to make the rest of the bill work. The first real substantive provision is Section 5 that requires disclosures. And the disclosure provision here is intended to allow a car purchaser to know exactly what it is that they will be paying on a monthly basis and in total if they purchase the car and purchase some add-ons or extra features. And some of those are listed there. The service contract, insurance products. It's common for dealers that have the proper licenses to offer a variety of different kinds of insurance products unrelated to motor vehicles, by the way, disability insurance or life insurance, things like that, and to roll the costs of that into the cost of purchasing the vehicle and the financing package that's related to the cost of purchasing the vehicle. The bill here would require that those items, at least in aggregate, be broken out separately and that their impact on the monthly payment of any financing be separately broken out as well. And this provision applies to all dealer transactions, used or new cars.
Okay, so members understand this applies to new or used.
Okay. The amendment that the author's amendment, A5, did make a few language changes in there in response to concerns raised by the dealers about the particular forms that they use, not being required to label the categories with any statutorily required words, as long as it's sufficiently clear and the information is broken out as required by statute. The Section 7 is the next substantive provision in the proposal. It deals with credit scores. When a and this would apply for both used and new vehicles. Frequently, in 60 to 70% of the cases with I know with regard to used cars, I'm not sure what the percentage is on new cars. When a person buys a car from the dealer, they finance the purchase through the dealer. The dealer acts as a broker or an agent for a finance company that lends the money to the buyer. In determining the qualification of the buyer for a loan and determining the terms of that loan, in particular the interest rate, the finance company typically will use a credit score to assess the risk of the particular buyer. This provision in the bill would require that the value of that credit score be disclosed to the buyer, along with some context for it, the range of possible credit scores that the company uses, and information on how to obtain more information from the either from the lender or from the company that makes the credit scores or the credit reports, so that the buyer can follow up if they wish to learn more about how their risk was assessed. Some concerns have been raised to me from the dealers about this provision, because the dealers were concerned about being put in a position of having to answer credit-related questions from the buyer. My response to that, and we can get into more of this later if you wish, or if the dealers wish, but my response is that the auto dealer is acting as the agent and is in fact being compensated, in some cases quite handsomely, for their role as the agent for the finance company, and that this kind of disclosure would be appropriate from the consumer standpoint to know how they are being evaluated for the risk and the terms of that financing arrangement. And then there is some language with regard to the particular notice that would be provided to the consumer, so the consumer gets adequate information on that question. Madam Chair, members, Section 8 was changed significantly in the A5 amendment. The Section 8 originally provided for a cap on what is known in the industry as a finance reserve, what can also be called a dealer markup on the interest rate that the finance company is prepared to offer to the buyer. So, for example, if I were to go in an auto dealer, decide to purchase this vehicle, new or used, and I want to finance it through the dealer will shop it to a variety of lenders or finance companies, and hopefully one of them would say, okay, Mr. Latz has good enough credit. We're going to offer him a loan at 4% interest rate. Then what commonly happens is that the dealer will turn around to me and say, we will offer you a loan to purchase your vehicle at 6% interest rate. And what the dealer doesn't tell me is that 1.5 points of that 2% increase will end up in the dealer's pocket, not in the lender's pocket. Nor will they tell me that I actually qualified based on my credit score and other risk evaluations for a loan at 4% instead of 6%. The cap that was originally proposed was taken out of the California law, where they have the only state that has a statewide law like this, and that number of 2.5% was derived from a national lawsuit settlement. In the lawsuit, there had been a substantial review, a study of the loan portfolios of GMAC and Ford Motor Credit, and it was determined from that review that African-American and Latino customers were typically paying 1 to 1.5 percentage points higher interest rates on their loans than white customers were paying. And the tipping point for that discrimination in the lending terms was around 2.5%, according to that study. So basically, whites were being charged a 2.5% markup, and blacks and Latinos were being charged a 3.5% or 4% markup over the lender's minimum qualified loan rate.
Senator Letts, before you go any further, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this was the result of a study in California.
No.
You're not asserting that this is happening in Minnesota, are you? I just want to be sure.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The study actually was done by a national consumer group out of Washington, D.C., that in the court had heard anecdotally of concerns like this, had initiated some legal action, and obtained through discovery the lending records of GMAC and Ford Motor Credit. When they then analyzed the contents of those records, this is what they discovered. And they weren't necessarily blaming GMAC or Ford Motor Credit, because typically, I mean, these are markups that occur at the dealer level. But this was nationwide data. I don't have any Minnesota-specific data, and I'm not here asserting that this is happening specifically in Minnesota. But that was the original concern for looking into these markups, aside from the fact, but also importantly, that consumers pay a substantially higher interest rate, and which is to say more, they pay more for the purchase of their vehicle because the dealer is getting a cut of the loan proceeds of every monthly payment that they make. So, for example, if they go in and negotiate a deal with the dealer that they, you know, they come, if they do their research, they can know what the wholesale cost, the dealer's cost is on a vehicle. It's available at any bookstore. You can buy the books. I'm sure it's online, too. And they can go in and negotiate, say, $300 over the manufacturer's cost. And then they're figuring that's basically what the dealer is getting for their, you know, for their profit or whatever number they can agree on. What the purchaser typically is not told is that in addition to that, the dealer is going to get another $1,000 or $2,000 over the course of the financing of the loan when the loan payments are made. And so really the purchaser is paying a lot more for the vehicle over the cost of the vehicle than they thought they were going to be paying. And then they felt they had negotiated with the dealer. And that is the other crux of the concern about a markup. Now, what the author's amendment does is it removes a cap so that there's no direct interference with the amount of markup, but it does provide for a disclosure of the markup amount, a disclosure that the dealer will be getting money from each loan payment, and that the amount of each monthly payment that will end up going back to the dealer is also disclosed, and then the total amount of the compensation to the dealer through the loan arrangements would also be disclosed, so that a buyer then would have more information available to decide if they wish to take that loan through the dealer, or if they think that they can get a better deal by shopping around. Because they would know also that they actually qualified through the lender for a lower interest rate. And it would be in their own financial best interest then to go do some shopping around. And so that's the crux of the provision in the bill as amended, a disclosure requirement so the consumer can make an informed decision. Move on to the next provision.
Well, Senator Vandeveer, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lance, we were discussing this earlier. Is there other businesses that have to tell everybody how much they're making on every deal? Did we find a comparable business arrangement like that? I mean, I don't have to tell my customers they can get an appraisal cheaper if they go somewhere else. Just wondering if that was figured out.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I have with me some others who might be a little more expert in that, but it's my understanding that when you purchase a house, if you get your mortgage through a mortgage broker, the mortgage broker's compensation for doing the work, finding the lender, and processing it is disclosed on the HUD-1 form. I'm not sure how extensive that disclosure is. I'm not in that area of law or policy, but a lot of that information, at least, is disclosed in a home purchase loan.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, there isn't anything in this bill that would require the dealer to compare their charges to someone else's charges, with the, like the example that Senator Vandiver gave. Is there? Isn't it just disclosing their own charges?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
I think
Senator Scogin, or do you want to follow up?
I believe Senator Vandiver would like a follow-up.
Senator Vandiver.
I guess if you're disclosing, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, how much what they are making off the loan, isn't that what your bill does?
Yes.
Senator Latz, yes.
Sure, yes.
So I don't know how many businesses have to disclose how much they're making on every incidental item or every service that they provide. I just don't see that, and that's kind of one of the problems I'm having with this part of it, is that they would have to disclose that, because we know when we go in to buy a car and we make a trade, for example, we may get a higher number for the trade but a bigger discount on the car, or the other way around, or the financing might pay. I mean, most of us realize that, you know, if we finance it there, or you know, we might pay a little bit more, but we got more for the trade-in or whatever. I mean, it's a package deal, and different services might cost different money. And to have to disclose that just seems like something new to me.
So. Senator Scogin, did you have?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just, it might be heading down that same road. I guess when I make a purchase, I expect to pay for services rendered, and if the dealer is helping me secure a loan, I expect to pay for that. I expect that to be in the price of the vehicle that I'm paying. I expect to pay for convenience.
How much?
But I know that I also have the opportunity to shop around before I go to buy that vehicle. And even after I see the paperwork at the dealership, I have the opportunity until I sign that paper to go shop around and look for a better deal. And in Minnesota, with no prepayment penalty, even shortly after making the transaction, if I think there's a better deal at the bank or the credit union, I can go make the better deal and go pay off the car. I don't know if we're holding up consumers other than consumers who don't have time to shop around, maybe, I guess. But otherwise, I think I know I have all of those options available to me.
Madam Chair,
Senator Latz.
Senator Scogin, I don't quarrel with compensating the dealer for being the lender's agent and, and providing that service. But I think it is fair for the consumer to know how much that compensation is going to be. You know, I'll give you an example. If there's a 1.5 point markup, say from 4.5% to 6%. The numbers. If there's a 3 point markup from 4.5% to 7.5% for someone with the best credit rating on a vehicle that is an average $14,000. They're going to pay another $1,166 over the life of the loan for the services of the dealer in originating that loan.
Right.
If it's a new car, the average maybe a $26,000 car, they're going to pay over $2,000. And if their credit is poorer, the numbers go up because the interest rates are higher, even with just a 3% markup. I might be willing to pay $300 to the dealer. I might be willing to pay $500 to the dealer. But I'd like to know if I'm going to be paying $1,000 or $2,000 to the dealer the dealer says, here, we'll sell you this car, here's the deal, $300 over cost. Now let's go finance it. And the dealer's making really all of their money on the financing, but they're not telling me that. I'm thinking I might be getting a good deal, but instead, in fact, I'm not getting such a good deal on the car. And most consumers, you know, most consumers, I think, are not quite as savvy. And I know I'm not as savvy as I'd like to be. I bring my brother-in-law with me who knows how to run the numbers in his head on these things. But to protect the consumers, I think disclosure would be fair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, and I guess where I distinguish your bill from other kinds of commercial transactions, for example, Senator Vanderveer and Senator Scogin, if we go into a retail business, we don't ask the owner of the business to tell us how much of a percentage they've marked up their coach or whatever it is that they're selling. But we do traditionally require disclosures when it comes to financing charges. And I think it's a little naive of us as consumers to think that car dealers can be operating a business with a $200 or $300 profit on each vehicle, because that probably they wouldn't stay in business. But I do think that it's important that we have transparency. And when it comes to things like financing charges, those are things where traditionally we have been protective of consumers in terms of transparency, so they can make those comparisons. And so that's why I'm supportive of this bill and would distinguish it from other kinds of situations.
Senator Scogin, did you?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson and Senator Latz, to that point, if I can remember it now, I think I always see on any type of loan what the finance charges are. But I don't ask the person writing the loan to break it down for me. Who's getting what? I don't care. I'm in a position as a consumer to make a purchase. I need the money to make that purchase. I'm willing to pay the finance charge. I get to see it. I don't need to see how it's broke down.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, transparency is important to me, but I would say that I forgot my point. Anyway, I think the issue here, though, is a little bit more than that. I mean, culturally, if we don't know we have to shop when we're dealing with car dealers, I mean, that's kind of ingrained in us, I think. And so if we have to protect people or tell them they have to shop,
differences in codes.
When they're buying a car, I mean, we would have to technically do it on just about everything. I mean, it's just everybody knows that. I mean, and to think that you're not going to shop the loan, the car itself, and you know, the other issues and services you provide, and that you don't get comparisons when you go to car dealers. I mean, we're going to have someone walk these people across the street. You know, when the light's red or green.
Madam Chair, there's a person here with legal aid who has a little more information to provide on how it works in the mortgage context. I don't know if you want to do that now or if you want to, should I finish walking through the bill and then?
Well, Senator Latz, yeah, I don't want us to get sidetracked. I really want to keep moving here.
Okay. Then let's move on to the next substantive part of the bill. Section 10 deals with certified motor vehicles.
That's page 6, members.
You may have seen lots of ads out there in which you can now buy used cars that are certified pre-owned vehicles. And that is intended to convey to the potential buyer some greater sense of confidence that if you go in and buy this vehicle, it has been somehow inspected more thoroughly, and often there's a warranty that comes along with that certification process. But there are no standards right now, no uniformity for the consumer to be able to judge whether something that's certified really has a meaningful kind of a reference point for them. So what this bill proposes is not to specify the laundry list of 100-point inspections that need to be done before a vehicle is sold, but it does provide some minimum standards so that at least the vehicle that is sold as a certified and for which the consumer is paying more, presumably, they know that they're not getting a vehicle that has a title branded salvage, or not getting a vehicle that has been in an accident and sustained frame damage, or is not a vehicle that was brought out of New Orleans and had flood damage. Those are the kinds of things that are intended to be covered here. Now, Minnesota does have some title branding requirements, and there is a lemon law in Minnesota. And, for example, if a vehicle were reacquired by the manufacturer under the lemon law, it could also not be resold as a certified used vehicle. But in Minnesota, our laws actually are relatively lax in their scope and coverage of used cars that are sold. Now, I'm not going to try to redress that in this bill. And I do have another amendment that you have, an A7 amendment, which would take some additional steps dealing with trade-ins and other things. But I'm not going to try to do that in this bill, Madam Chair. I think there'll be another day for a broader discussion on these kinds of questions. But what I do want to do, at least, obviously with your concurrence, is to set some minimum standards and some responsibility on the dealer that if they're going to make an extra profit by certifying a pre-owned vehicle, that it not be a substantially damaged vehicle, not one that has come out of a flood or other kind of situation. Lots of vehicles come into Minnesota because of our relatively lax title branding statutes, come in from out of state without proper title work or without a clear history, and get resold here as is. And this bill would do nothing to stop a dealer from selling a car as is. But it does suggest, and with the author's amendment that was added, it suggests that if the dealer knew or should have known that the vehicle had a checkered past, then they cannot sell that as certified. That is one more consumer protection in this bill. The final substantive component of the bill, Madam Chair, is Section 11, the contract cancellation option. And this is the return policy, or cooling off period, as they call it in California. I modeled this provision on the California law, but I did a little bit differently. California's law applies to used cars all the way up to well over $100,000. And maybe that's the Beverly Hills provision, but I'm not trying to cover that here. So this provision would only apply to vehicles that are under $40,000 in value. It only applies to used cars. It is good for 2 days. That's not to say dealers couldn't do better than this, but at a minimum, they would have to be willing to take a vehicle back within 2 days. Now, there are some protections in this provision as well, protections to try to avoid abuse. One of the concerns, and legitimate concerns by the dealers, would be that someone would turn to a purchase of a used car from the dealer as a short-term rental and think that they can pay the $25 or $50 transaction fee, whatever it is, maybe less, get out of there for a weekend, take a joyride to Chicago, or use it for a prom date or whatever, and then return it the next day or the next in the next couple of days. And to me, that would be an abuse by the consumer. And so there is a mileage cap that is in here, so that a vehicle that's driven, you know, the dealer could make the mileage cap higher, but at least 250 miles would be the cap on the on what the vehicle could be driven in order to qualify for this return option. There would be a restocking fee as well, And this has two purposes. And the A5 amendment modified some of the dollar amounts and when they kick in, but it's basically at a graduated rate. For a vehicle that's $5,000 or less in value, the restocking fee would be $125. Between $5,000 and $10,000, the restocking fee is $250. And as you move up the scale, you get up a little bit higher to a cap of $500 on the restocking fee. Now, the restocking fee would serve two purposes. One is it's, in any case, it's far more than the cost of a weekend rental. So it would be more expensive for a consumer to use the vehicle, use this mechanism, the return policy, as a rental than it would be to simply go out and rent the vehicle. So we would avoid that problem. The second piece is to compensate in whole or in part the dealer for some of the administrative costs involved in utilizing or in making available this two-day return policy. I understand that there would be some holding costs involved. There'd be some paperwork costs involved in unwinding the transaction for the dealer. I don't know that it necessarily makes it is more expensive to do it for a more expensive vehicle, but I figure if you can afford a more expensive vehicle, you can afford a little more restocking fee to help cover the dealer's costs in dealing with this. There are some dealers right now that have this kind of a policy. I've got an ad here from Larry Reed's Chrysler Bloomington Jeep, which appeared in Auto Mart, one of those free publications you can pick up around town. Why buy from Larry Reed's 5-day, 500-mile, 100% money-back confidence guarantee? And it doesn't say anything here about a restocking fee or anything like that. So they must have found that as a marketing tool, it is very effective for them to be able to say to a potential customer, you know what, you can buy the car, and if for some reason in the next day or two, or in this case 5 days, you decide that you really don't want this car, bring it back, that's okay. Dayton's used to have a very generous return policy on shoes. I used to sell shoes there. I used to take shoes back that smelled of the gasoline people used to clean it up, but they took them back because it was important for them to be able to tell the potential customers, give it a try. So what we're saying is they ought to have that option. Luther has a pre-owned peace of mind return exchange policy, and I've got some of the information from them online. That's a 300-mile and 3-day policy in the same basic condition as when it was purchased. CarMax.com has a 5-day money-back guarantee with every used car and truck. So this is already present in the industry. It certainly is something which can be done. Now, I have had direct conversations with two consumers who had complained to the Minnesota Attorney General's office about purchasing vehicles and tried to return them and were not allowed to do so by the dealer. Now, I'm not at liberty to disclose their names, but I am at liberty to disclose the contents of their situation. So I'd like to describe that briefly for you so you understand I'm not just whistling Dixie here. There are real consumers out there that have had these problems. One individual went shopping for a truck, was looking for a vehicle valued about $5,000. The salesperson convinced him to let the dealership see if they could qualify him with financing for a $15,000 truck. He came back the next day. He was qualified. He felt he was pressured into signing the purchase. In any case, the same day he returned the truck, or he tried to return the truck, dealer wouldn't take it back. The buyer left the truck on the lot. It sat there for 30 days. And the buyer tried to get the money back. The dealer sent him a letter, said, if you don't come pick up your truck, we're going to consider it abandoned, and we're going to keep the truck, but you're still going to owe on the financing loan that you took out. This individual was not willing to come testify or go public because there's one dealer in his town. That's where he gets his vehicle repaired. It's a 30-mile drive to the nearest dealer, and so he felt kind of stuck. Another individual purchased a $20,000 vehicle with her son or on her son's behalf. The next day, they attempted to return the vehicle when they decided they really couldn't afford it. The dealer indicated that all deals were final. The buyer even offered to let the dealer keep $2,000 of the $5,000 down payment. Dealer refused. Individual is still trying to work it out with the dealer. They are at, this has been going on for at least 6 months or so I'm not confident that they will. The dealer's stonewalling, but she was embarrassed and frankly not willing to go public for fear that it might affect her ability in the end to try to resolve it with the dealer. So these really are happening out there, which is a reason why I think this is a, I expect this to be a bill which consumers would really like. In California, they did some polling before they passed the law there, statewide polls on the topic. And they found that 82% of the public, when the provisions in the bill were described to them, which include essentially all of the provisions that are before you today, 82% favored the bill, 75% of them strongly. The lowest demographic of consumers that didn't like the bill were white Republican males at 70%.
Oh, you got it. Senator Gerlach.
Chairman, I thought we were working on a fine bipartisan bill here, nonpartisan.
It'd be certainly nonpartisan.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz. If the market trend on the last issue of the return policy, if the market trend, as you held up many examples of five-day return policy, no questions asked, et cetera, if that is the market trend, that sounds like a good trend. Why do we need to follow and lag behind that with legislation when clearly the market is realizing that, as you said yourself, why can't we just let that trend continue? It may not be perfect, and every individual, you know, may not want to do that. But then they're going to be on the losing end of a marketing advantage, if that's the trend. Why do we need to follow this up with legislation?
Senator Latz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, for one thing, the market is not perfect. And the market doesn't work in a lot of these cases. In greater Minnesota, there's far less competition, for example. And I'm only aware of these couple of dealers. There are many, many, many dealers in Minnesota. So if it's a trend, it's at the very beginning of the trend. But independent of that trend, I would assert that it is a consumer fairness, a consumer protection provision that, regardless of the market, ought to be in state law. Mr. Sparks, Mr. Chairman, in responding to the committee's questions, I think I've taken up more time than I had anticipated. I know that there are some in the audience that want to speak on the other side of some of the provisions in this bill, but I also do have with me Galen Robinson from Legal Aid and Nick Slade, who is a consumer attorney specializing in auto matters, and I'd ask if they could be given a few moments to convey their views on this legislation as well.
Thank you, Senator Latz. I think you did do a good job of explaining the bill. And as Senator Shy did say, we're going to try to give 45 minutes to this. So we want to have your witnesses have an opportunity to testify. But if you could kind of keep your comments brief, that would be appreciated because we do have three other people that like to testify on this bill, and we have three additional bills up. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And I will try and keep this very short. My name is Nicholas Slade, and as Senator Latz said, I am a consumer rights attorney with Berry and Slade, and about a third of my practice is my entire practice is consumer rights issues. About a third of my practice is dealing with auto sales issues. And I do really want to urge the members of the committee to pass this. I do think it is a very good bill, and it will provide significant benefits to consumers, largely on the basis that any time a consumer has more information, so that they can make a better informed decision about what they're doing, it is good for everybody. And this bill is largely about guaranteeing that they have more information. In order to keep things short, I think what I'll do is jump really directly to this issue of the markup. And as Senator Latz indicated, that a large part of this is based on more on national studies and past historical abuse in an attempt to stop these sort of things, that where minorities are often the victims of markups, especially when the information is concealed from them. And one of the things about this, the need for either putting a limit or, as Senator Latz has suggested, is that finding out about the amount of the markup is very difficult. And the only in my practice, I've only found the level of markup only through discovery after commencing a lawsuit. So it would be very difficult for any consumer to really get a good grip and understanding absent some sort of clear disclosure to them up front. And so for that reason alone, I think it's important that they be given that. But to go more to some of the questions, as was stated, the information is given in a real estate transaction, which is probably the closest transaction in nature to a car deal. Purchasing a car is often the second most expensive purchase a person ever makes in their lifetime, behind a house. And some of the complexity is in both purchasing the car and understanding the financing is very similar, and which is why actually you now see Denny Heckert, who started out doing car loans, is now doing real estate loans. They're very similar in nature. And for the exact reasons that information is disclosed in a house, in a mortgage, it also should be disclosed with cars. But one of the other things that is going on, and one of the questions asked was, we generally don't get the information about how much somebody is marking up the price of something, and that's true. But the difference here is car dealers are playing two roles. They're selling you the car, but then they're also working, and they would suggest somewhat on your behalf to go out and find the best loan for you. And in doing that, you should have the right to know how much they're charging you for that extra service. And that's one of the major differences, is they're all of a sudden, instead of being on the opposite side of the table from you where they're selling you the car, they've come over to your side and said, well, I'm going to help you find the best financing. And that shift in role and the confusion that goes on in the blending of those roles is a very important distinction that I believe is one of the real reasons for making these disclosures. In addition, the dealers, because they're adjusting this rate and they're setting the markup, they're actually playing a direct role in determining the amount of the loan and the rate at which you're receiving the loan.
Hang on just a minute, Mr. Slate. Senator Vanderveer.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Slate, don't you get that APR form that you sign when you do the loan at the car dealer that tells you the effective interest rate that you're paying and how long you're going to be paying it?
Mr. Slade?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer, yes, you do. But again, the difference, I think, is really that when that's presented to you, that's presented as the APR that is being offered by whoever is going to be accepting final assignment of the loan. The difference being, as I stated, is the car dealer has played a role in setting that, and that they have set the final. They're the ones that set the final number because they set the level of markup. But they've also played this role where they're saying, "Well, I'm going to go out on your behalf. I'm going to shop around and find the best deal for you," and you aren't really getting full information about what they're doing on your behalf and how much they're charging you unless they clearly disclose that. And that, I think, is that's really the big difference, is you need that information so that you know what role they're truly playing, how they're taking part in setting that final APR, and whether or not that, in fact, is a good deal. As Senator Letch just mentioned, it's kind of like dual agency, and that is exactly what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Slade. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Galen Robinson. I work with Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, and I've been a consumer lawyer for them for over 20 years. I've worked in our outstate offices as well as our urban offices, and I currently work with attorneys throughout the state on these kinds of issues. I'm not here to talk about the technicalities of the bill as opposed to why I think this bill is very important and necessary for low-income consumers. Many of our clients are working their way off welfare. They've recently worked their way off welfare, and transportation is a critical issue. They need to get to and from work. They need to get to and from daycare. They need to get to and from the grocery store, in and around the metro area. The need is perhaps even greater when you get to greater Minnesota, and the distances are much greater. Loss of a car creates an extreme crisis for these families. And throughout my practice, I've seen countless clients who've run into problems with cars that don't work, and they're stuck. They're still having to pay for the car if they've signed a loan on it, yet they have no transportation. We had one client who bought a car. It was under $7,500. The very next morning, it stopped working. Nothing she could do about that. She's out the money. She still doesn't have a car, and she still has to pay for the car. We have other clients who go in, and they don't understand the nature of the transaction. In part, to address Senator Vanderveer's questions, you know, the disclosure that this bill would allow is very important. Many of our clients, and it's not just the interest rate disclosure, it's the other disclosures that I think are critical. They live on, from month to month, on what their income is that month. And they aren't sophisticated consumers, unfortunately. I'd like them to be, but they aren't always. Oftentimes what they look at is, how am I going to make ends meet this month? They look at a car. What are the monthly payments? Can I afford to make those? Sometimes they make a good decision. Sometimes they don't. Some of the provisions in this bill that would permit them to see the cost of extra products they're buying so that they can see what those two different monthly costs would be would help them make an educated choice, might prevent them from making a choice that leads them to not being able to pay for that car later. That disclosure is important. In terms of the disclosure of the financing, you know, I would suggest that this really is a marketplace issue. In most other cases, you may not know what the markup on is on a product, but you can shop for a coat and see that that coat is offered at Kohl's today for this much, similar coat at Penny's, similar coat at Dayton's, and you can make a choice. When you walk into a car dealer and you negotiate the price of the car, before you know what the financing is going to cost, you're not making the same choice. And as far as the marketplace, if clients are told how much the cost of getting that loan from the dealer is, I would think overall in the marketplace that would lead to more competition because other lenders would know what the rates are and people will be able to find choices that they don't know to look for right now because they aren't sophisticated consumers. I know you have other people here who want to speak about this bill. I just would encourage you to seriously consider this because it has the inability to return a car that doesn't work, the inability to know what a car truly is going to cost are critical issues for low-income consumers.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Senator Lance. I think there's a few more people who'd like to speak to the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Scogin.
While they're making the transition at the table, I guess just in response to the last comments, if they don't understand the nature of the transaction, I doubt that they would be any less likely to understand the nature of the bill being split up. Just
wanted to make that point.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Lambert. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Auto Dealers, and I will be brief. Ms. Shalander will address some specifics in the bill. We also have a guest who's traveled a great distance. We'd like to try and get him up today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you take it from, if you listen to the testimony, you might draw the conclusion that we just absolutely hate our customers, that we're here to be more abusive to them than helpful. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's just not the truth. We like our customers, so we'd like them to return. We'd like to see more of them. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that we can, our industry can put ourselves up against any other retail experience and prove that we treat our customers as well or as better as anybody else. In fact, Mr. Chairman, our whole business is wrapped around our franchise agreement is wrapped around our ability to keep our consumers satisfied, and if we don't, the manufacturers will be punitive about it. Customer satisfaction is critical to our business needs. Mr. Chairman, members, new and used car dealers will conduct about 600,000 transactions a year. I don't think I have heard anything that suggests that there is any kind of widespread problem or even really a small problem that we are addressing. And the proponents of the bill are correct. In the main element of this bill, some of the dealers have formalized policies for return. And I don't know of any dealer who won't help a customer out of a problem. I can't speak to the individual problems that were testified to here because we don't know all sides. But most dealers are willing to help customers out with their problems. And if dealers are already coming forward with return policies that are even more aggressive than this bill, that leads me to ask, why do we need a bill? Why can't we let the market handle this? Members of the committee, this has been termed a bill of rights. I would suggest consumers are already pretty well protected. The car buying process is, by its nature, a lengthy one. There's a lot of time for second thought, a lot of time for reflection on it. There are already dozens of disclosures made to the consumer throughout the transaction, and this bill is going to add at least a half a dozen more, possibly more, some of them even redundant. Mr. Chairman, on this retail installment sales contract alone, there are easily a dozen disclosures that the consumer sees, and this is just and has to sign off on. This is just one document. We're still not looking at the title document, the buyer's guide, the purchase agreement, service contracts. At some point, Mr. Chairman, these just become meaningless. We're just hogpiling on the consumer, and we need to focus on what's important. And we think that we're doing a good job informing the consumer of what's happening and what's in these documents. I am sorry. We did speak with Senator Latz. I'm sorry we couldn't come to an agreement over the basic elements of this bill. We think we had some basis for agreement. But, Mr. Chairman, at this point, we think this bill is overly bureaucratic, and, frankly, it's overreaching. And with that, I've tempered my remarks a bit, and I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Shalander.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm the lobbyist with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, and I just wanted to try to clarify a little bit the discussion that has been going on around the dealer financing markup. I think to call it a markup is really misleading to everyone. It implies that there is somehow an extra charge on the consumer. And as you know, I'm sure everyone has financed a vehicle, and I think Senator Scogin had touched on the issue of annual percentage rate. Federal regulators have spent over 20 years branding the term annual percentage rate for the sole purpose of allowing consumers to know exactly how much the cost of credit is, so that consumers know that if you are being offered a 5% APR at your dealership and you can get a 4% APR at your credit union, that you're comparing apples to apples, that you're obviously getting a better deal, you know, somewhere else. Out of that APR that consumer is paying, the dealer and the lender are make an agreement in the secondary market as to how much the lender keeps and how much the dealer keeps. I just want to make it clear that this particular section of the bill dealing with dealer finance does not regulate the terms of the agreement between the dealer and the customer. It's talking about the terms of the agreement between the dealer and the bank, if you will. And so to imply somehow that the dealer is charging something extra to the customer is not true. Or that the terms of the loan that we're talking about, the buy rate, which is, for lack of a better term, the wholesale cost of the loan, we would be the retailer for that loan, the customer would not be able to get that rate on their own. So for them to know that is meaningless, because it's not as though, I think it was said that you know, the customer should know that they could go out and get the rate that we get, and they can't go get. I mean, maybe they could do better than we can do, than what the APR that we're offering them. And we encourage them to shop and to compare APR. But to suggest somehow that we're marking up the buy rate is, that's not how this market works. And in addition, I think it's been overly simplified that the dealer is somehow just getting some flat fee off of every loan arrangement that they set up. You know, these arrangements are various and in their form, and they're various in their amounts. And at the point of sale, at the point where we're being asked to disclose this information, the dealer may not know at that point how much a dealer reserve they're going to be agreeing to with the lender after the fact, because that agreement takes place after the consumer has entered the loan, and then we sell the loan to the lender. So, you know, the dealer finance reserve could be a straight commission, it could be a flat fee, it could be a fixed portion of the interest rate. In certain cases, it could even be that the lender, who does a lot of volume of business with the dealer, the lender is offering certain other incentives to the dealer, some, you know, other, if they've got other accounts or things like that. And, you know, and frankly, there is a market. The secondary market is a market for loans that they... It would depend on various factors about, you know, just simple supply and demand amongst lenders, how much demand is there for that particular type of loan. Can we provide the lender with volume of loans? You know, how much customer default is in our history with that particular lender in that relationship? So my point is that these agreements are varied and they're complex, and that what we're being asked to disclose in this particular section is, A, not knowable to us, and B, I think, really is going to just cause nothing more than confusion for customers. When right now we've got this situation where customers are easily able to compare apples to apples. They know exactly what the APR that's being offered to them is, and they know that they can take that number, APR, and compare it in any other variety of you know, vendor circumstances. They can go to their bank, their credit union. They can go online, you know, eLoan, Capital One, whatever. They can do this all, you know, at home. They don't even have to come to the dealership to do this. Somehow, if we're now going to require dealers to disclose how much the dealer gets on the secondary market for selling the vehicle loan to a lender, now we're going to have a second comparison. We're no longer going to have customers comparing apples to apples. They're going to somehow think that if the dealer is charging them less on the loan, or the dealer's not making a commission. And, you know, that's where this is going to go. The dealer's going to start saying, well, we're not making a commission on the loan. Well, then, you know, in the end, the customer is just going to be confused as to what they're trying to shop for here. So I think we're really, really complicating this unnecessarily, and we are not by any means providing the customer with anything of benefit in constructing these kinds of complicated disclosures and requirements here. So that's I guess my spiel on the financing, and I know time getting short, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Metzen and Senator Scogin.
It ought to come at this from a different angle. I think Senator Latz might have some good ideas, but I'm thinking more like globally today, and I question the timing of the bill. Dealerships are closing, and I've had two or three out my way every single month in Minnesota. You don't have to be a road scholar to look at the business section and see what GM, Chrysler, and the troubles that the manufacturers are having. And if we have some good idea, and I happen to chair the business community or committee that we try to actually promote businesses if we can and encourage a growth in the business industry in Minnesota. And I think this thing goes the opposite way. Now, there might be a couple of good ideas, but it's the timing that troubles me so much, and I just don't want this to be one of the nails in the coffin that continues to hurt. And we want the industry to come back, and I think GM might have made some money the last quarter, which is good news, but I just don't want to add problems to the existing problems that exist out in this business world.
Mr. Chair, to the time constraints, I know they brought someone in from a distance. I'd like if we could just quickly go to that witness and then.
I think that would be a great idea, you bet, because we are fast approaching the end of our time. So welcome to the committee. We want to give you a chance to tell your story, though.
Thank you, sir. My name is Henry Bird. I'm corporate counsel with CarMax. I want to thank Senator Latz for introducing you to us. I flew in from Richmond last night. I thought I was going to have dinner there. I had it here instead. CarMax is the nation's largest used car retailer. CarMax is a Fortune 500 company with 12,000 employees across the country. We have been selected as one of Fortune's 100 best companies to work for 3 years in a row. Our business model is that of a retailer. We're a child of Circuit City. We are not a traditional dealer, used or new. We operate 77 stores in 36 markets in 22 states, including 7 stores in California, where the California Car Buyer Bill of Rights is in place, and we plan to grow at 15 to 20% a year. We are under contract for a piece of property in the St. Paul area and expect to close on that property soon. So we are not here simply as outlanders. We are here as interested, soon-to-be property owners, and we plan to come and do business in your state and look forward to that. In the last 4 reported quarters, we sold 342,000 cars retail, 205,000 wholesale, and had gross revenues of $7.2 billion. Our problems with this bill are these. First, you've got the 2-day return period. CarMax, our offer is this. We do not haggle on price. We do not haggle on trade-in. We do not haggle on financing. We will buy your car even if you don't buy one of ours. We offer, and that offer is a written offer good for 7 days. We offer a 5-day money-back guarantee, as Senator Latz mentioned, and we offer a 30-day warranty on every car we sell. We also have a clean title guarantee that lasts for the life of the vehicle, and that means that if it turns out there has been flood or frame damage to the vehicle or there is a title brand that becomes disclosed, we refund the customer's money in its entirety, even if the customer has driven the car happily for 7 years and 120,000 miles. The issue with this bill is mechanical for us. We are doing well in California. We're doing well under the California Car Buyer Bill of Rights, but there are some pieces in this bill that are problematic. The first is the 2-day refund period. You have a 2-day cancellation period, then you have a 2-day requirement to refund the money. That's an invitation to fraud, and we have suffered the effects of that repeatedly in California. The invitation to fraud goes like this. You come in on a Thursday night, you write a check for the car, you come back Friday night, you turn the car in, and we have to refund your money with some sort of negotiable instrument by Sunday night or Monday night, depending on what the laws in the state are. The way to fix that is fairly simple. What you can do is either extend the refund period to 10 days, 7 days is really the absolute minimum, 10 days is best, or you can start the refund period after any down payment check has cleared. That's how Oregon has done it. This bill is in Oregon. This bill is in Missouri. This bill is in Massachusetts. And that's how Oregon has done it, and that's a good way to do it. I would encourage you all to look at an amendment that does that, because otherwise you're looking at an awful lot of fraud opportunities on dealers, which is going to make the price of vehicles go up for everybody. The second is that if the vehicle that is traded in is sold from under the is sold before the two-day period is expired, the dealer is required to refund the money by one of two measures, either the amount in the contract or the fair market value, and that term is not defined so far as I can tell. As I said, CarMax has we have purchased over a million vehicles since 1993, and we have without exception, the most one of the most sophisticated valuation systems in the country with regards to what the value of a vehicle is. The reality is that fair market value must be determined individually because cars are not fungible. You've got to look at the individual vehicle. I would urge you to remove that language, fair market value, from it and require dealers to stand by their contracts. That's what we do, and we urge you to make that change. Lastly, there is an issue of something called negative equity. People may trade in a vehicle, and they may get $9,000 for the vehicle on the trade-in. They may owe $11,000. The dealer will pay off that $11,000 lien and roll the excess $2,000 into the next purchase. This is allowed by finance companies around the country, assuming that debt ratios and all the rest match, and is often done. This bill does not allow for dealers to be protected when they have rolled negative equity in. They're required to refund the amount of the vehicle, and they have no recourse to retain the money that is owed under the negative equity. There is some language that we have offered in other states we would be happy to offer to you. Lastly, with regards to the new amendment, the finance disclosure, the way CarMax's financing works is different. We do not mark up, and we do not have a buy rate, sell rate approach to our financing. We are compensated on a flat fee basis by our finance companies. Those flat fees are different between the different lenders. And when we deal with finance companies, though, you were talking about some very sophisticated, given that we sold 350,000 cars, some sophisticated commercial arrangements that are highly proprietary. And what's happening here, unfortunately, is your bill will punish those of us who are doing it right, which is we don't mark up on an individual basis. We don't negotiate on an individual basis. We offer the same rate to everybody, and the consumer selects which financing agreement they want. They typically get at least two and often three offers. So I would urge you to look at that bill and look at that language in a way that allows for folks who are compensated on a flat fee basis not to have to disclose that, because you're talking about wrecking some very sophisticated commercial transactions. I appreciate your time. I realize it's been a long time, and we're grateful for the time here and look forward to doing business in Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Byrd. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the testimony from this gentleman as well as from the dealers and the questions from the committee. It's given me some ideas as to how I might fashion the bill in a little bit better way that might be more comfortable for all the people that are interested in it. And with that in mind, I'd ask if the chairman would please lay the bill over for further consideration at a different meeting.
We can certainly do that, Senator Latz. We will lay the bill on the table.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I appreciate the time that the members took to hear this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Higgins is in the room. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I would like to take up 1262 first.
Okay.
Because I have an out-of-town guest here who knows way more about this bill than I do. So, Mr. Chair, members, you might remember that last year, just about this time, there was a little boy in South Minneapolis who pulled a charm off of a Reebok tennis shoe, something that had come as a kind of an extra gift with purchase of a pair of Reebok tennies. And he ate that little charm, and he died. Turned out that charm was filled full of lead. And it made us realize that there are a lot of jewelry-type products, and especially those that are marketed to kids, especially the cheap little trinket kind of jewelry, that are pretty much unregulated in what's in them. And much of it contains hazardous materials like lead. So last year, I put in a bill that just flat-out banned, you know, lead in jewelry. And after talking to the industry folks, I realized that it wasn't quite as simple as just banning it. So over the interim, we worked with the jewelry manufacturers and all kinds of folks who worked hard in California and I forget the other state, where they actually got laws passed dealing with lead in jewelry and little kids and dying. And so Senate File 1262 mirrors very closely the California bill. And, you know, in the perfect world, we would have a federal response to this issue. But in the meantime, the states have taken this on as an issue, and we will go forward state by state, and hopefully we can get some pretty similar legislation so the manufacturers have a standard to go to. I have with me today a gentleman who worked on the California legislation. He's from the industry, and he will tell you what this bill does.
Senator Higgins, before you move on, did you have an amendment you'd like the committee to act on?
Do I have an amendment?
I think the clerk brought a copy down to you, an A1 amendment.
What do I have? I think that might be the other bill, Mr. Chair.
1262.
May I see it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, it came from your office. I think the retail merchants might have been a factor in it.
Oh, that, I am not offering that.
Okay, that's fine.
But, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment on page 7. Wait a minute. Do I have a different piece? No. Page 7, I'd like to delete lines 7.28 to 7.30.
Mr. Chair, I move.
That would keep... Get rid of the rulemaking authority. If somebody would move that, please.
Council has that. Senator Solon moves that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins?
Hey, Mr. Michael Gale is here.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gale.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'd also like to introduce Ms. Dee Moss, who is a jewelry supplier to many retailers and whose business is based in Minnetonka. I have been in the costume jewelry, now known as the fashion jewelry industry, since 1957. Most of those years as a sales representative and more recently as the director of the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. Very sorry. I shut that off once. And I apologize. One of the purposes of our association is to have a national standard for jewelry, particularly children's jewelry, so that everyone will know that the jewelry that children are given is safe. And we spent 2 years in the California action under Proposition 65, negotiating with the California Attorney General, environmental groups, the retailers, and the suppliers. And we came up with a series of standards that have been acknowledged by all of those parties and the Consumer Product Safety Commission to be safe for children. And the definition of children was increased to the age of six, even though the mouthing behavior drops dramatically in children after the age of three. The standard is 1,000 times more strict than what is considered safe by the scientists, the medical community. And so we've gone to great lengths to insist that the industry meet these standards, which it is doing now. And fortunately, thanks to Senator Higgins, the bill in front of you follows those same standards. Those standards have been adopted by certain states and are under consideration and the bills have been sponsored in New York, in Maryland, in Indiana, in Illinois. Illinois actually passed the bill, in Michigan, and many other states are considering these same standards. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission is considering changing their recommendations to a rulemaking policy, unfortunately, and also with these same standards. Unfortunately, they do not have a quorum. They need five commissioners to enact any regulations in CPSC. They only have two right now. So nothing can happen on the federal level until the president nominates and the Senate confirms at least one more commissioner. And under the present political situation, that's not too likely for a couple of years. And so we are asking you to favorably consider Senator Higgins' bill and have Minnesota follow the standards that have been set in other states and are being considered in many other states. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Moss, would you like to add anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. This is the first time I've been here, and I'm a Minnesotan from birth. But my company started in 1970, and I think that I, in my company, have always echoed the integrity and goodwill for safety of any products. And so I think that a lot of work has been done in presenting this to the state of Minnesota. And I think that it is something that would be very beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you please just state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Deanne Moss, D-E-A-N-N-E. Last name is Moss.
Thank you very much. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just I know we're under time constraints now because we spent a lot of time on the previous bill, and just wondering if there is any opposition to this, if it exists, if we could hear that, and if not, I feel fully informed and ready to vote on this and move this bill out of the committee.
Okay.
Well, concur.
Well, I see one person standing up, but good try. Would anyone else like to testify on the bill? Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. And my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers. I guess I've been here many times, so you know who I am. What you may not know is that retailers come in all sizes and shapes in terms of my organization. You all know about JCPenney's and Sears and Target and so on, but you may or may not know about Norby's Department Store in Detroit Lakes or the Oof to Shop in Red Wing or Patina in Minneapolis. You all have those types of mom-and-pop independent store owners in your districts. It doesn't matter where you're at, you got them. They all sell fashion jewelry, what we used to call costume jewelry. And there isn't one of them that disagrees with the goals of this bill. So I thank Senator Higgins for doing that. I mean, I think this is important. The problem is there's an unintended consequence here, and that is that if you're one of the larger companies, you have capabilities that smaller companies don't have. They have chemists, they have metallurgists, they have buying agents, they have buying power to dictate terms on the kind of products that they get. Now, the penalties are really severe in this bill. And what I'm trying to do is to make sure that those small retailers in small towns are protected from the unintended consequences of maybe selling something that they don't want to sell. Again, they don't have the expertise to be able to check every single item that they purchase or that they run through their store. So I want to make sure that we're able to protect their interest because, again, the penalties are so severe. Now, I want to thank the gentleman to my left and the lady who spoke to, because they are working with us, along with Senator Higgins, to try to come up with some language to protect those smaller retailers from what could be devastating for their business, when, in fact, it's the unintended consequence of something they really never had intended to have happen. There's one other matter here, too, and that is you may not know that Goodwill Easter Seals is a member of my organization. One of the reasons they are is they have a $20 million wholesale operation, and they sell a lot of, again, fashion costume jewelry. The jewelry that they sell actually comes from donations from your constituents and maybe perhaps from some of you. Now, what happens to them when they take in a piece of jewelry? What liability do they have? Again, that's the kind of thing we're trying to work out in the amendment, and we will continue to work on that today. So, again, to protect their interests as well. You probably all know that they use that income. It's a nonprofit organization, but they use that income to provide assistance to low-income people for drug rehabilitation, job training, and other kinds of really important social services. So I don't think that anybody wants to harm Goodwill Easter Seals business either. The matter is we're just trying to find out a way to protect those people who, in fact, share these goals but don't want to suffer any devastating consequences if, in fact, they get involved in the sale of something they don't really intend to sell. I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Questions from the committee? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Anderson makes some good points, and now you're confusing my decision-making here. But where are in the bill is the penalty section? I'm trying to figure that out.
I'm sorry.
Hang on, Senator Gerlach. I think counsel can help us with that.
Page 4, line 11.
Senator Higgins, thank you.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It's the only one I found.
Senator
so far.
Gerlach?
All right. Mr. Chairman, this is
sometimes since I've read it. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. It's been sometimes since I've read it. I'm just looking right now.
That's the whole section that they referenced. Yeah.
Senator Gerlach.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it's Subdivision 3 violations. The public and private remedies of Section 8.31 apply. I'm no expert in 8.31. As a general philosophy, when something is new like this, I always like to start kind of at the lowest level of kind of, you know, I don't want to bring out the sledgehammer until I've used the claw hammer or maybe even the small tack hammer if necessary. I don't know what the details of these penalties are, but maybe as we, you know, I don't know how if we do this here. This is probably something, because the penalties probably got to go to judiciary.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I think that's right, and that would be an issue that we can work out okay. There. That'll give us one more stop to work out the issues with Mr. Anderson as well.
Okay, because Mr. Chairman, my suggestion would be is go to the lowest level possible, see if you solve the problem, and then if a couple of years the problem's not solved, well, then you can ratchet up the penalties, but starting out at a higher penalty, if that's the case, and again, I don't know the details, but Mr. Anderson is saying that the penalties seem to be steep from his perspective. You know, maybe start out low, and then if that doesn't solve the problem, work up. But I guess we're not going to solve that problem now. Well, then, Mr. Chairman, if I could also ask Senator Higgins, the donation piece, the goodwill is an example of the donation piece. Hard to, you know, a lot of that stuff's in circulation already, and it's being donated and such. Are you making some progress with the retailers on resolving that? Is that some good discussion, dialogue, and such, and is that likely to be resolved?
Mr. Anderson, Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson's in my office almost every day lately. So we're
is that
talking.
A good thing, Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair,
he's a lot more pleasant than some people.
Oh. Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, in Senator Higgins' defense, this is something that just I've become aware of in the last few days because I started thinking about my membership and who might this affect. So that's something that brought to her attention very late. And I think, again, we're trying to work through how do we resolve that. Maybe there's an exemption for nonprofits. You know, I don't know what the answer is, but we're looking at how do we deal with that.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, if you'll send us off to judiciary, we'll give it another shot.
Senator Higgins, we can do that, although counsel may have something to add.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really see anything in the bill that requires a stop in judiciary. And,
it has not been requested by judiciary.
It hasn't. You're right.
Senator Higgins.
But...
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach.
If the violation section, if that's adding penalty, is A3.1, is that civil or criminal or both?
Counsel. Mr. Stang.
Senator Gerlach, we've often in consumer protection legislation, we cross-reference section 831, which is attorney general enforcement remedies, things like civil penalties, private right of action, injunctive relief, elements of that nature. But we've passed many bills out of here referencing 831 that have not gone to judiciary.
Senator Higgins, fine. We send it to the floor, and we'll trust that you and Mr. Anderson will continue to
We can send it to the floor, and if Senator Moi wants to yank it back, then we'll go back. The floor sounds good to me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon moves that Senate file 1262 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted, or the bill is passed and sent to the floor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Mr. Chair, I have one more bill that might be easy as well after I make an amendment or two.
Senator Higgins, I think we can do it in 10 minutes. We had a bill of Senator Latz that took a lot more time than the committee had anticipated.
I think it's a 10-minute bill, Mr. Chair, if I can find my
committee
copy
members
of it.
Willing to plug on? Otherwise, we do have a big agenda on Tuesday.
I'm fine.
Senator Higgins, let's give her a shot. Senate file 1441.
Somebody bring me a copy of my bill. I seem to have walked out without it. It's 1441.
Senate file 1441.
And Mr. Chair, I know I have an amendment, or maybe it. Maybe it's Senator Olstein's amendment about. I'm just combobulated. I can't do this without a bill.
Senator Higgins, slow down.
No, this is the other one. Mr. Chair, I think what I would like to start out with is delete section 1.
I don't have the
since it since it fights with the bill that you just passed.
Okay. All of it?
I think so. For the time being, yes.
I have the bill.
Senator Scogin moves that section 1 of the bill be deleted. On that motion, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, continuing on the lead theme today, we have one provision left in here, and it deals with requirements for paint retailers and requiring them to offer copies of the EPA's pamphlet named Protecting Your Family from Lead, and placing a poster that's visible in the paint department that informs customers of the right to receive a copy of the pamphlet and to offer for sale a lead dust testing kit that's capable of determining the presence of lead-based paint hazards. Mr. Chair, there are 1.2 million houses in Minnesota that have lead-based paint in there. Pretty much anything that was had paint on it before 1978. And little by little by little, we're making those houses lead safe, in some cases, you know, actually removing the lead. But there are still a lot of families who don't know that this can be a problem, especially for the pregnant women in their family and the children in their family. So this is just a simple requirement that the pamphlets be available and that there's a sign there so that people can learn about the hazards of lead. If for example, they're going to burn the paint off of their house, you know, if they're like me, they have a house that's 107 years old, and if you actually go and burn that paint off, the lead can get sucked right into your brain, I think. I swear I feel it when I do it. But, you know, I'm fairly well informed on it, and I still do it, so, you know, don't ask. But There are people who just don't know that that's a hazard, and there are other ways that you can make your house lead safe. So that's that simple requirement, and I think Senator Olstein has a...
Senator Scogin.
Why am I calling you Senator Olstein? I'm sorry. Senator Scogin has an amendment.
They're all new.
Jeez, I'm sorry.
Senator Higgins, I've been called worse. that
Senator Scogin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll move the A1 amendment.
Okay, let's see. We'll get a copy to everyone first.
The A1 amendment committee is going to talk about Spanish language disclosures. Apparently there was some concern that people of Spanish language were having trouble with the lead warnings, and they asked that this be included. I was willing to carry it to the committee.
Do members have a copy of the amendment?
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
HUD
Higgins.
Has the pamphlets already available.
Pardon?
HUD has the pamphlets already prepared.
Okay, okay. Further discussion on the Scogin Amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Oops, oops, okay.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Gerlach.
I got to digest this for a moment here. Senator Scogin, okay, a real estate broker, real estate salesperson who conducts business with a potential home purchaser, primarily in Spanish, shall, prior to the negotiation or consummation of any transaction, provide to the purchaser translation in Spanish of disclosures required. Well, this is just the lead. Okay.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator
Scogin,
the EPA produces the pamphlet. Do they produce that pamphlet in other languages? Do they produce a Spanish translation?
Mr. Chair, at this point, I would introduce the witness at the table, I think, and have him answer those questions.
Okay, that's fine. Welcome to the committee. Please
thank
state
you,
your name for the
Mr.
record.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elliot Ginsburg. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Acorn. Yes, HUD has official versions of the lead disclosure already translated into Spanish. It's just a matter of asking for those pamphlets in Spanish and providing them to people who are purchasing houses that are conducting real estate deals primarily in Spanish.
Okay. Mr. Ginsburg, have you spoke to the realtors at all about this amendment?
I have not, no.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gerlach.
Senator Scogin, have you spoke to the realtors
I have not.
At all about this? I mean, I don't know what other impact this might have.
It came to me as a request from Mr. Ginsburg.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I do know that there are quite a few realtors who specialize in working with Spanish-speaking families, and most often they are themselves Spanish-speaking. So I think it's one of those things where it's a fairly defined group of people, because it's the salesperson who conducts business with a home purchaser primarily in Spanish. So, if you get like one every once in a while, this wouldn't apply. But if you conduct your business with a lot of Spanish-speaking folks, I think this is good business. I think the customers would appreciate it as well.
I would also like to just...
Mr. Ginsburg.
I would like to tell two quick stories about two Acorn members. I will not take more than a minute each. The first is a woman, Bernarda Rivas. She was involved in the Johnny Ricaldi campaign. He was a realtor for Coldwell Banker. He conducted the real estate deal with Mrs. Rivas primarily in Spanish and only provided the lead disclosure warnings in English. As a result, she wasn't aware of the problems of lead paint or how she could go about checking for lead paint or removing lead paint. And her son was found to have had lead poisoning several weeks after moving into the house. This is one reason why Spanish lead disclosure seems like it should be required when real estate deals are done predominantly in Spanish. We also have another case, Melitón López, a very similar situation. Four children living in the house. Lead disclosure was not given to him in Spanish. He was unaware of the problems of lead paint, and all four children suffer from elevated levels of lead in their blood.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm sensing
Scogin.
A problem with this amendment. And I believe that Senator Gerlach, are you?
Mr. Chairman, it starts going. I just don't know. I don't know. I mean, I would wonder about the question about, well, what about other languages?
Senator Gerlach, maybe.
And what about a conversation with the realtors?
Right. Senator Higgins, can I have a suggestion? We're going to have some other vehicles that we could attach this to. Could we have some further discussion, allow the realtors possibly to weigh in, Mr. Ginsburg?
Yep. We sure can.
Yep.
Senator Scogin, would you remove your
motion?
I'll
withdraw my A1 amendment.
Thank you, Senator
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, that's it.
Okay.
For 10 minutes.
Senator Metzen moves that Senate file 1441 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? No. The bill is passed and sent to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, committee. Sorry it took a little bit longer. We will meet again on Tuesday and take up Senator Clark's good faith bill along with several mortgage bills. Senator Scogin, thank you for allowing Senator Higgins to move forward. We'll move your bill to the list on Tuesday. With that, folks, and also reserve some time. If we don't get done, we will be back at 6 o'clock on Tuesday evening in room 112. With that, the meeting is adjourned.